The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, now, when someone's arrested on suspicion of committing a crime, how much should we, the public, be told about the suspect before the formal charge? In the absence of concrete information about the alleged perpetrator, rumours can spread, suggesting that the suspect may have a particular background, and this can and has led to public unrest. It's a concern that is shared by the authorities in Britain. I'm joined by David Robert Grimes, author of The Irrational Ape, How Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, what is the problem that the UK courts have been encountering?
So recently, the UK Law Commission has been discussing some reforms towards the contempt of court laws in England and Wales. And the reason they've been looking at this is because there's been a massive problem with speculation over the ethnic origins or the immigration status of supposed perpetrators in high-profile crimes. So we saw this in 2024 with the Southport attacks, where there was wild speculation online about the perpetrator being an immigrant or from someplace foreign, when they actually turned out to be UK-born. And that led to all the violence and the riots and the things we've seen. Again, the Dublin riots were also partly fueled by speculation over the immigration status of the supposed perpetrator. Now, because this has become such a problem with every high-profile case, online speculation, the UK Law Commission has started looking into their contempt of court laws. And what they've started thinking is they might include things like name, age, nationality, religion, and immigration status after a person is identified as a suspect. And that, of course, is a huge sea change in how things have been done previously.
Now, would that be before charge or only after the person had actually been formally charged?
So under the draft reforms, that contempt liability would begin when the suspect is charged, not when arrested. So again, this is a case of when there's a charge coming out before it goes in front of the court, but the person has got a charge with it. Now, this will be done on a case-by-case basis. And again, this is only a draft reform. And that would be down to the wisdom of the judge, whether publishing these details would create a substantial risk or whether it would go towards mitigating some of the misinformation problem. But this just shows you how huge an issue that misinformation has come and how easily weaponized things about immigration have, particularly by the hard right. Now, this is not, by the way, non-controversial. Some feel that it could reinforce stereotypes about immigrants or non-immigrants, and some victims' families are opposing the proposed changes.
Now, recently, the police have actually taken it upon themselves to specify that in the case of suspects that they were, for example, UK-born rather than otherwise. But the problem with all of that is, unless it's formalised, that if they don't say that they're UK-born, there will be an automatic supposition on the part of those who wish to exploit it that they're in fact immigrants.
And that's exactly the problem. And the fact that the UK police, for example, during the Cambridge train attack, were very, very quick to come out and say this is not an immigrant, shows you that it's indicative of the fact that this has really been a problem for law enforcement. And again, the stuff that's happened online. Now, you're right. If that, and this is still going through the Reform Commission to see what they'll come up with, but it is not something that is a fit-all solution. And also the fact that judges will have, you know, leisure to decide whether this should be made public or not after the charging stage means that there's a little bit of leeway on that as well. But it is very, very indicative of the scope of the problem we're having, that this is even being considered. I mean, for years, this has been something that has been relatively protected. And the fact that it's openly being discussed in the UK is certainly telling where we are right now.
Now, it's complex because sometimes identities are not revealed to protect victims or others who might be, close to either the perpetrator or the victim. So it's not just a black and white situation, if you'll pardon the awful pun.
Sure, and it won't be a one-size-fits-all thing, but it is a damning indictment of where we are that the consideration is people's ethnicity and religion might have to be specified beforehand. It shows you how readily weaponized this has been, particularly by the far right in politics, both in Europe and in the USA. And if you see any major high-profile crime or breaking news story, and you go online and you go into the cesspit that is Twitter, you will see loads of speculation very confidently identifying the perpetrator as an immigrant, even when that is almost always overturned. There's no corrective strategy on social media. So this is, again, part of the things that we could do to mitigate this is that we could teach people to be a little bit more media literate and to realize that social media speculation, particularly in an evolving situation, is easily weaponized by those that wish to spread disinformation.
Now, compounding this problem is the deliberate nature of this kind of misinformation on the part of the far right, that it's not just ad hocery, it's actually part of a strategy.
Oh, absolutely. And also, it's amplified by huge voices. We saw with the Southport attacks last year that Elon Musk, for example, was retweeting, say, Tommy Robinson speculation, and that got millions upon millions of engagement. So when you look at it, by the way, and I should always point out, because I always get criticism for this, anyone can fall victim to misinformation, anyone can spread disinformation, left or right of a spectrum. But we have to remind ourselves that only the far right have politically weaponized this. So there's a study back in February in Holland that looked at politicians in 26 EU countries and finding that amplifying misinformation was a part of the far right strategy for populists, whereabouts that didn't happen as much as politicians on the left. So this has definitely been weaponized. It can happen to anyone, but the right has been weaponizing this. And this is precisely why this reform is being considered right now.
Now, one of the great problems is that if we're looking at something that reinforces our own ideology, our own prejudices, that we might be more tempted to believe that than one that confounds our prejudices.
Exactly. We have what's called motivated reasoning towards embracing the stuff that feels familiar or feels right to us, and where it's we tend to reject the stuff that doesn't. And that's always been seen in how we process information in general. But now it's being seen with misinformation. So there's a recent study came out on the Australian elections, and it surveyed different people that had partaken in them. And they found that about 60% of the adults had encountered some form of misinformation, but they felt overwhelmed by it and had the lack of skills or the lack of time to fact check it all. And what was really interesting is, again, we saw on this that people were far more likely to be partisan in how they, you know, rejected misinformation. If they were left-leaning, they were far more likely to accept misinformation that was negative towards the right, and vice versa. If they were right-leaning, they were far more likely to accept something negative about the left. And this, by the way, shouldn't surprise us, because we've seen this a lot before.
Now, people are aware of the likelihood of misinformation online, and they would support a little help for themselves in moderating all of that.
Well, actually, that's really interesting, because the Australian study found that about 70% of those surveyed thought the government should restrict false information on social media, and 83% supported national truth and advertising laws. So there is a real public feeling that we need to do something about this. And again, people felt overwhelmed when people were tested on this in the study. Only about half of them were able to correctly identify misinformation. So there is a crying need for this. Again, there's a lot of opposition from social media companies to any form of regulation. And the deep problem, Pat, is that even trying to get a government to regulate is almost impossible to do when you're looking at the massive birth of the internet and particularly social media. Because it would have to be a transnational campaign in some ways. And it's so overwhelming when you have social media companies who are bigger than some countries.
Now, you have an example in your book, The Irrational Ape, of a study by a guy called Dan Kahan, who was looking at the way we perceive issues depending on our personal biases.
Yeah, so Kahan was based at Yale, and he gave people a probability test, basically to work out if a skin cream was better or worse, to gauge people's mathematical ability, if they could do numbers and percentages and things like that. And when it was a neutral topic, you know, he identified the people that were good at solving it. And then what he did is he gave the same problem, same numbers, but now traded around to be about gun control. And it was randomly assigned to people. And in some people, it would give it a strong argument, if you follow the data, that gun control reduced crime. And in another one, it would give the argument that gun control increased crime. And of course, these are, you know, always ubiquitous talking points of the right and left in America. But if it fell into the hands of someone who was formerly good at mathematics, who was very pro-gun control, and the example they got said that gun control would increase crime, they suddenly got bad at the maths. And the same thing happened in reverse. If you got a conservative who got data that suggested that gun control would be good for crime rates, they suddenly rejected it as well. So Kahn called this identity protective cognition. So the way that people would massage the data in their head to try and agree with the conclusion they already had because they felt some membership of a group, and that group had a particular ideal and ideology that they were straining to agree with, even when it defied their mathematical intuition and their ability.
And this was a stark issue, gun control, increasing or decreasing crime, polar opposites. But obviously in more subtle issues, the same kind of psychology would prevail.
Absolutely. And what we see now, by the way, going back to immigration, is now you're seeing the same thing. If you show people data, for example, Ireland's net immigration fell last year. Right, it's going down. And again, our amount of immigrants that even come, the raw immigrants, is actually less than 1.5 Croke Parks, of which, you know, about 25% are returning Irish people. So it's a small number. But that's not the impression people get. And if you show them that data, if they are very much feeling that immigration is an issue, they tend to reject that data. Whereabouts, if they're more left-leaning and they're okay with it, that they're very quick to accept it. So we have issues like this. We have blind spots in our ideology that make it very, very difficult for people to accept raw data. And this is something that the misinformation problem has crept into, because people who spread disinformation, deliberately trying to distort people, know that this is a really rich vein to tap.
David Robert Grimes, author of The Irrational Ape, How Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk. David, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.